The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
One example will be, you know, what happens when the battery runs out on a computer while the software is running. There's certain computers that are going to like save state hard drives. Some certain computers just keep it in RAM, and when you restart it, there's no big difference. What happens when the IM window pops up in the middle of the game and needs control of the screen? And suddenly you're typing, you know, and all your keys start appearing in your IM window. ideally the game should pause at that point. But you know, catching those things, one of our favorite things that we do when we're making digital games here in the lab is to like slam all our fingers on the keyboard at once and see what happens. And you're kind of looking for those things, but you're also looking for the subtler things of, like, you know, when you're, you know, is the amount of RAM that this game is taking up in the computer slowly going up all the time? And of course, comparing it against the spec, right? You know, so character is supposed to be able to create a certain fireball spell or something when you enter this key sequence, and 99 times out of 100 that works, and that one out of 100 doesn't, and you need to figure out why. That's all. So now in a lot of those situations, what happens is that output comes back in the form of bug reports. And you, how about you actually do program? How do you have filed a bug report? Not that many. Okay, so there's a, you know, there are a couple of best practices where you file a bug report, and this sort of actually translates a little bit into when you're going to be working in a team in the game. So how do you communicate that something is wrong to someone else who's also responsible for your game, but may not necessarily have seen the problem? You know, and first of all, you describe what you were expecting to happen and what you were doing. You know, I was expecting to go right when I pushed the right button. And then you write down what happened. And you try to give as much detail as possible for the person to reproduce this problem. Now, when it comes to, you know, board games, in many situations, you can the kind of detail that you need to provide largely comes out the game stage. So, you know, player A had this much money, player B had that much money. They tried to do this game mechanic, and no one knew what to do, you know, because the way how the rules are written, there's more than one way to interpret it. And that gives your team enough information to be able to start acting on it. Because you're making board games and your rules are kind of right out there in the open, it's usually less of a mystery to see where the problem actually is. Like, you know there's a problem and it could end, and you largely see where it lies. We don't know what to do to correct it. And that's actually where playtesting comes in. But I'll get to playtesting a third. But technical testing, a lot of it again is comparing it against a spec. Sometimes that spec is created from your team. This is what we want our game to do. This is what we're expecting to happen when we make this game. We expect that late in the game, a certain game mechanic will start to take priority over other game mechanics. You know, early on, everyone's buying properties in Monopoly, and later on, everyone's going to be building houses, and then even at the end, people starting to mortgage stuff. That's what we kind of expect to happen. And then you play the game, and then you start realizing mortgaging is happening way too early. Something's out of whack here. So that's the kind of technical testing that you do in the game. You know, this is what we expect. Why isn't it happening? The other side over here is kind of like being the defender of the player, you know, being the player's advocate. You know, how can you be the person on the team that is actively looking for things in your game that are going to hurt your players, and then mentioning it and says maybe we should do something about that. Sometimes it's as simple as here's the information that we want our players to have at this given time. Here's the game state. You know, your characters have a certain state. They are this close to winning, or they're this far away from winning. They have these resources to play with. Do the players understand that? Do they have enough? Are you providing them with enough information to be able to make a good decision. If they know the game state, do they know what options they have in front of them? So if you, as we play more and more board games this semester, you can actually look at the way how rules are presented redundantly. Sometimes they're written up, you know, in the rule sheet, but then you've also got those sort of index card size thing, which, you know, goes through like step 1, 2, 3, 4. These are the four things that you got to remember every single turn, and do not forget it. And everybody has a copy right in front of you because somebody on the team decided that that was a good idea. How they came to that conclusion varies. Occasionally, they're doing it because they see there's a problem right away. There's too much information, and you just don't expect that a player is ever going to be able to grasp all this much information. So that's come up with a couple of ways to simplify it for them. Sometimes that involves taking out mechanics, sometimes it means representing it in a different way. You know, making something that was written out in text graphical, for instance, or icons, reducing all the numbers by 2 so the math becomes easier, that sort of thing. But sometimes you do it by usability testing, and that's one kind of testing that often comes together with playtesting. I've invited Sarah Borelli, our development director, to come in here and talk about the kind of playtesting that you can do, which is this really make this picture. And the book goes through several different kinds of environments where you do playtesting. That's, you know, sitting in front one-on-one with people and doing this like testing with a group. If you're playing, because this class is all about board games and card games, for the most part you're designing games for 3 or 4 people at a given time. The chances are almost every single test that you're going to do is with 3 or 4 people at a single time. That's just the environment your game is meant to be played. That's what you end up testing in. Obviously, if you're doing a single-player computer game, that's not necessarily the environment they're testing in a given time. Before I transition over, there is one thing I do want to mention about technical testing. That sometimes the specs that you're testing it against are not the ones that were necessarily come up with by your own team. If you're doing a computer game, say for an Xbox or a PS3 or a Wii, there are these things called technical certification requirements. Which are basically these huge lists of things that your game must do before Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo allow it to be released on the platform. PC obviously doesn't have this, but you know, if you release it on Steam or something, then chances are they'll have requirements. You know, it could be something as simple as, you know, generally doesn't crash, which even then games do crash even on PS3 and Xbox. But you know, you get like things like, you know, what happens when you're playing a game on the PS3 or Xbox, actually more on the PS2 and the first Xbox, and then someone yanks out the cable, you know, or you're playing Guitar Hero or something and the cable comes out, what happens? Has anyone done this? It goes into a pause, right? And it usually tells you your controller is disconnected. And that's a requirement. Someone had to write that code specifically to detect that situation, and then and then throw up the screen, pause the game. And the reason why they had to do that is because Microsoft and Sony and Nintendo, well, not so much Nintendo nowadays, because Nintendo went wireless really early. But you know, these are the kinds of requirements that they expect. If you lose your connection to Xbox Live halfway through the game, then something's gonna happen. So again, for that kind of technical testing, you're sort of comparing it against spec, but that spec may not necessarily be something that your team came up with. It may be something that your publisher or your platform developer, your platform manufacturer mandated. How this applies to board games is that sometimes board games are actually going to require have sort of requirements similar to that. If you're responsible for the design of the box, for instance, then there are things that are going to require on the outside of the box, like, you know, what ages are, is the game applicable for, how long is it meant to be played, how many people are going to be playing your game. I think Days of Wonder, which is a publisher, actually requires a character to be on the box. Even if your game has no characters, there must be a human-like person on the box for your player to identify with, because they think that increases sales. And they probably have the numbers to back it up. That's why if you look at things, I think like Ticket to Ride, for instance, has people. If you play, you'll play Ticket to Ride. The game has no people in it, but you have people on the bus because it's a because they want people to think that's what a game is about. So that's just an example of things that that a board game publisher might require you to do. Very common will be like you'll have to do translations in a range of different translations for the different territories that we release in. It may not be your job to do it. The publisher might actually end up being the ones helping you with the translation and getting all the information together, formatting it, and releasing it. But someone along the stage is doing making sure that happens before your game hits the shelf. Okay, so that's technical depth saying. That's a little bit about defending the player. So let's talk about playtesting a little bit. And focus on it.
Playtesting and focus testing. Okay. So let me bump you here. Yeah. Bump your computer.
Oh, right. Cool.
Yeah. No rush. Okay. Let's see. Let's actually go ahead. Focus testing. This is a very similar to the lecture I give the summer program folks. And I have about 10 minutes to go back and look at my notes and relook at the lecture. So if it's a little stumbly in parts, it's because I haven't given it for a while and haven't thought about it. It's much more geared. The original talk is much more geared towards computer testing. And testing specifically single-player computer games than testing board games, which are almost always multi-user. So hopefully we'll be able to do that. So first of all, focus testing is actually a misnomer. Focus testing is only a specific case of user testing, which is to say you're testing your game using actual users, not your development team, not people who play board games 12 hours a day because that's what they love to do all the time, but more the sort of average person who might want to pick up your game off the shelf, go buy it, and then go play it with their family, and then go out to dinner at Chuck E. Cheese's or something. Another type of user testing is also usability testing, which is fairly similar to focus testing in as much as you're still using users for it. Focus testing is usually much more geared towards, are people enjoying your game? Do people want to play your game? Is your game doing, are people going through the sort of play experiences you want them to have as they play their game? Because usually when you create a game, you're thinking, oh, like for Settlers of Catan, you expect people to spend a lot of time talking with each other, trading things back and forth. When you're making diplomacy, you expect people to spend a lot of time arguing with each other over, well, if you invade that country, I'll invade that country, and we'll gang up on him, and we'll lock him out of the game, and then we'll just divide the board between the two of us and win. While you're making secret underhanded arrangements with the other guy that, okay, so he's going to attack you this round, we both know that, so, and that sort of thing. As opposed to, say, Transamerica, which is just more putting pieces down, and it's pretty much independent play in many ways for each player. Usability testing is much more about how easy is it for people to play your game. Do they understand your rules? Are the mechanics clear? When they sit down and start sorting out the tokens, can they tell which tokens are the player pieces and which cards are which and how you use those? Do the icons on your game make sense to people to understand them? Things like that. It's not really about whether or not people like your game or are enjoying your game. It's about can people understand your game and start playing it properly. Those are the things you can look at. Here we go. One big problem we run into when people sit down and they have people playing their games and giving them lots of comments is this was really fun, or this really sucked, or I hate this part where I have to spend time talking to the other players. I want to be able to stare at just my cards and my board and move completely without interacting with anyone else, which is that focus testers will give you lots and lots of feedback. Some of it is useful, some of it is not. And you need to remember that the focus testers are not actually people building the game. Focus testers are the people who you're trying to get information about your game from. And one problem that we often see inexperienced game developers and people who make games doing is, oh, the focus tester said we had to make the whole game red. Quick, let's make everything red. So, and that's usually, that's not, for example, a good solution, right? Who knows what the problem actually was, but what you need to do is find out, why did the players want to make everything red? Is it because they don't like the artistic design of the game? Is it because someone in the game is colorblind? Someone who's playing the game currently is colorblind? Is it having a hard time telling things apart, and so they'd like everything to be the same color so everyone's having the same problem they are? I mean, who knows? It's hard to tell what people are thinking. So when they give you advice and when they give you all these comments, you have to have some way to filter those comments, some way to think about them, and some way to decide what actually is the right action to take in view of what you want your game to do and how you want people to play the game. Since you're the game designers and the game developers, you have to make those decisions. The focus testers can only give you data. You shouldn't ask them to design your game for you. They may actually have good ideas that you want to use, but you want to make sure that they're good ideas that you do want to use. So, you may notice these are both my lectures, and these are pictures that my Harappa drew for a poster, and we love them so much. So, in the ideal focus testing situation, you'd really try to get as much data as you can about your player playing the game without spoiling the information. What you really kind of like to recreate in a lot of ways is, so you've just bought the game and gotten home, what happens? Which is what this picture is all about. Here's someone luring someone in to play the game without actually any information. You're there. Okay, so things to think about. Let's go back. So the things to think about when you're planning your focus testing is, what are you testing? What questions do you want to ask? What information do you want to get out of it? How are you going to test it? How many players do you need? What kind of interactions do you want to see? Things like that. And who are you testing with? What kind of people are going to make your game? Are you making a game for children, age 9 to 15? Are you making a game for college-age students? Are you making a game that you think that older players will want to play? Because if you're making a game that you think is going to be popular with the senior citizen market, testing it with a bunch of elementary school kids probably isn't going to work very well. Trivial Classic Edition, a game that came out about 20-odd years ago. I suspect that if you sat down a group of high school students with it and had them play it, about three-quarters of the questions they just stared at you going, I've never even heard of that. So that's sort of where the audience comes in. So the what. Planning out the questions that you think you're going to get information for. When you know what information you're looking for focus testing, it's a lot easier to know what to keep track of, how to take notes, what reactions you're most interested in as people are playing the game. So what questions are you going to ask? What data is needed to answer your question? And how are you going to get that data? Are you going to do it all through observation and taking notes? Are you going to just step in and ask them questions? So why did you move that character from there to there? Just out of curiosity, I'm wondering why you made that move. Can you tell me about it? Or are you going to ask them to fill out a questionnaire at the end of it? Depending on what data you want, different methods will work best. In general, the best way to do it is observation. As soon as you ask someone questions, you sort of perturb the system. And when you ask them to fill out a survey, it's after they've done it. They've kind of forgotten what they were doing. They may not exactly remember. And to be perfectly honest, people would really rather play your game than fill out a form. So they'll be more engaged, more interested, more interactive when they're playing their game. And that's when you're going to get your best data. But there are times when you want to ask someone something sort of analytical. And you don't want someone to be thinking analytically while they're playing the game in a lot of ways. And so there are times when that reflection comes out much better, and it's better to have them to have that written down and get it in their own words recorded.
You would hope your game's better than a survey.
If your game isn't better than a survey, you've probably already observed a problem right there, and you're probably glad you found it. So how? In order to get all that data, you're going to have to actually interact with the user, someone who's never seen your game before, someone who doesn't actually care whether you or not you get good information out of playing the game. Usually what they did was they came here to sit down and play the game. And while they'd like to help you by giving you information, that's not their primary goal in a lot of ways. Usually their primary goal is to sit down and play the game and have a good time. So you need to be able to structure the interaction with them so that giving the data to you is as easy for them as possible. So we need to think about what does the player need to know before he or she sits down to play. Usually in a board game or a card game, that's the set of rules. In a computer game, it's always trickier. Usually when we're bringing in people to test the first prototypes, we have a game that works, but we don't have the instructions in game. If we're going to have a tutorial or anything like that, that's usually one of the last things that goes in. So when you're testing computer games early in the process, usually you end up sitting down and writing down, well, this is what the tutorial would look like if we had it. So read this and then sit down and play it. With board games and card games, it's actually a little bit easier because you can say, aha, this is the rules that's going to be packaged with the game. Give you the rules, step back and see what happens. That's actually an easier aspect for testing for board games. And finally, treat the players politely. When they find a misspelling in your rules, when they discover that you left out 6 of the key cards to play the games, oh, yeah, you're right. Thank you for pointing that out. I wouldn't have noticed that if you hadn't shown it to me. Whether you would have or not doesn't really matter. They're doing you a favor by playing your game that isn't quite working well. So you want them to know that their contribution is valuable and you appreciate the time and effort they put into it. The thing is, the more they talk about your game and the mechanics they find that breaks or that do or don't work, that's all data right there. That's all great. Another big advantage of testing board games is you get groups of players, 2 or 3 or 4 players. And when you have multiple players, they'll talk to each other about it. Oh, I noticed this. Did you notice this strategy? Yeah, I did, but I noticed if you use that strategy, that you can do this thing or this other thing. And that's all really neat. When you're testing single-player computer games, like we usually do in the summer program, you've got a single user, and they're just sitting there between them and the computer. You have to watch, figure out what they're thinking or whatever. When you've got a group, it's not that hard to get them talking about what they're doing and what they're thinking. And so that's a really good way to try and get more data. Here's sort of the end summary. Just have a specific question or questions in mind. Know why you're doing focus testing. Know why you're doing usability testing. If you don't know what you're trying to test for, then your data is going to be a lot harder to figure out what to do with. So you always want to have that question in mind. That's actually the really big one. Know what data you need to answer that question so you can collect it and know how to collect it. And make sure that you can give the information to the players, a standardized set of information to the players, and step away so you're not sort of coloring the information you're giving and the thing you're talking about so that you've actually got sort of a standardized play groups to compare against each other. Okay. I think that's actually most of it right there.
A couple of words about when to do testing, which is really as soon as possible. Usually, before you think it's possible, you should be already starting to plan your first test or your test. Because at that point, you're probably going for the lowest hanging fruit, which will be probably somebody else in this class, because they're going to need feedback from you anyway, so you can use that favor in exchange. The whole point about doing testing as soon as possible simply is you want to be able to get the information while you still have time to fix it, to do something with that data. And what has happened a lot of times in this class is we'll have a project team where they come up with a game that requires, say, generating so many cards, or that they're going to spend most of the project deadline actually creating those cards. They'll test it, but they'll test it among themselves because the team's already gathered and they're not looking for other people. They have a plan to ask the friends to come in for a specific time and to set aside an hour or something like that. So what happens is that the last week comes around and they start playing it with people who've never seen the game before, and then they discover the problems. Unfortunately, the game has 100 cards that all now need to be fixed. This is a problem because you've just discovered that problem too late. couple of ways to handle that. Scope one, don't design a game where making changes across your entire game is going to take you more time than to test it, because that's just going to make it impossible for you to fix anything. But the other one is just not testing early. As soon as you've got a couple of key mechanics down, sure, you're planning to play this game with 100 cards. Start with 20. You know, start with a small group of cards, test your core mechanics, see people understand it. Because they're going to discover things in the production of those 20 cards and the testing of those 20 cards that maybe you don't want to be doing for the next 20 cards. And you can redo those 20 cards pretty quickly in a way that you can't redo 100 cards. Just an example. I'm really worried about not encouraging people to do a 100 card game, by the way. You know, regular poker deck, 52 cards, that's all you need for a really interesting game. Let's see. Some other things. Say you're doing a test, but it's not with your entire team present. Say it's just you and, you know, your teammates are all living in different dorms, and you decided to play with folks in your dorm. You know, that's great. You've got a full game, and you've got your feedback. How do you communicate that back to your team? I talked a little bit about, you know, writing up a little bug report, but here's a couple of other tips. Because one thing you have to remember is that chances are every single idea in the game, somebody in your team is probably really passionate about it. And what you're basically trying to do is convince someone in your team that maybe this should be changed. And your game will probably be better for it, but there's some tactful ways of doing that. So let's see. Keep it short. This also applies to bug reports. I talked about giving people enough information to reproduce what the problem was, you know, so that they can understand the state of the game and why this problem is occurring. The flip side of that is not too much information. Not more information than is necessary. Keep it short, you know, little forum posts, little email, something that's easy for people to scan. Don't make them read an essay for them to figure out, you know, what problems could be solved. Now, actually, one thing to keep in mind, and if you think about what Sarah said earlier about the data that you decide to collect, one problem with board games is that when all this interesting conversation is happening around the table and multiple players are suggesting strategies to each other, you can come up with reams of notes in a single playtest session. How you decide to digest that is very important. And if you're the only person there, and you need to, if you're the only person on your team, and you need to try to let the rest of your team know, you need to put in the work of digesting all that information before necessarily just giving the whole view to your team.
One possible solution, also, if you get permission from playtesters, is for example, tape recorder. Just pull out a digital recorder and record all of the conversation going on. Let's say people listen to the actual.
Oh, but you still want to pick up the clip. You don't want to make them listen to the entire recording. Because, you know, if the game took an hour and every single one of the team members listens to it for an hour, you just lost 3 man hours. So you want to find that clip, do that little bit of work to save the rest of the team time. But that's a great idea, because then you can focus. You can actually take down notes on the main points and just let the tape recorder record all the details, so that you don't have to worry about recording details and really the main points of the things that you want to make sure that you get across to your team. The team record is just evidence. You could use video, depending on who you're recording with. Sometimes people get kind of antsy when they notice a camera. That being said,
you can also just point the video at the board.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you're not recording the players, you're just recording the game.
Actually, webcams are really good for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you don't run out of tape. You know, you just record it straight to hard drive, straight down.
Easy to fast forward through also.
Yeah, easy to edit in tools. Let's see. Yeah, so when you're reporting to other people, things like bullet points are your friends. Huge long paragraphs of prose, not so much. Let's see. Try to avoid using the following words: broken, problem, unusable, confusing, kind of odd. You know, these you can get more specific than that, but these are words that kind of like imply not only is there a problem, someone made a mistake in designing the game in a certain way. And truth be told, most of the time it wasn't a mistake. You just didn't have enough playtesting information when you designed it. But you don't want to make someone feel like they made a mistake, because that makes them defensive, and then they're going to try to defend why what they wrote in the first place was correct, which is actually not correct either. So avoid those things. You can talk about, you know, features that need attention, for instance. We should pay some attention at this feature. Could be improved. I guess that's actually on the edge. But just generally keep your, you know, pick your words carefully. And one thing that Sarah mentioned earlier was, you know, testers are not game designers. And game designers are actually not the testers. For the most part, you are immediately going to exclude yourself from your target audience because you know so much of them. This is also covered in the book. You know, as soon as you play through your game once or twice, that's it. You're kind of worthless as a tester. You can still be a good technical tester, I guess. You know, you can still check whether certain mechanics are working the way that you want to work, but you can't tell whether the dynamics and your settings are working. You have to get your focus done. You know,
also really can't tell, you can never serve as usability tester on your own team. It'll always make sense to you. It's amazing what makes sense to you. It's completely incomprehensible to a very intelligent person who can really get to. Really, truly. I've been thinking about this one myself, and I should.
Usability testing, by the way, is one of those things where really, even if you only get a chance to do a partial test, like, you know, all I have is this one card. The game's not complete. But grab someone walking down the corridor, you know, on the way to the washroom and say, come in here and take a look at this thing I'm working on. That, even that bit of information.
Hey, kid, want to
take a look? Come in here. I have something to show you.
I have surprise for you.
We're not actually
shooting
insults and
then
getting
tested
here.
Miyamoto actually calls it employee kidnapping. It's like a cost, but of course he's, you know, creative director of the movie, so he can do that.
Yes, it works best if you're costing people who you have power over.
The audio thing, by the way, is one of those things that could be really useful if people are difficult to convince. And so it might be one of those things that you want to keep in reserve. It's like, okay, there is a problem here, and the team goes, I don't think there's a problem here. I don't understand why anyone's having a problem here. Then you bring up recording. Because it's kind of a bludgeon, actually, on your team. It's kind of, on one hand, if you have a good natured team, they're going to hear it and says, oh my god, we have a problem. And they'll immediately try to fix it, which is awesome. On the other hand, it's like, well, you know, do you need to actually trot out a recording for every single problem that we have? You know, some things we know are problems and we'll just do it. So keep that in reserve. I think that's pretty much on this. I have an exercise, but I can bring it out so I can kind of write it out. Do you have any questions while I'm going to grab the exercise bits?